I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hi everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening. It's a privilege to be able to talk to you every week. And in many ways, a joy. This has been a wonderful experience, this podcast, for me. And something I greatly, greatly treasure.
Me too.
Yeah, it's very close to my heart, in spite of it not being particularly pleasant always.
Are you going back to Crime Con this year, Dad?
I'm going to.
We won't be there on Podcast Row, I'm afraid, because I'm not available.
No, I'll be at Crime Con. I'll be there on the Sunday.
On the Sunday.
Yeah.
Some of our listeners might be there.
Yes, come and find me. I'm doing a panel on the new edition of my book on Frederick West.
Are you selling copies of your book there?
I am.
That's excellent.
Because the publishers have organised all that. Mm-hmm. And then I'm doing a panel of three or four woodcut people about what makes people evil.
The old classic.
It's a classic, yes.
Not one we haven't covered.
No. Now we shall cover, no doubt, many more times.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah,
but I found a wonderful
Are
quote,
people
actually.
Born evil? Geoffrey is pulling out a book by someone who looks like they lived a long time ago.
Yeah, well, this is Augustine's Confessions.
Which was written in when?
Well, a long time ago, let's put it that way. But he does say in book two of Augustine's Confessions, it was very kindly given to me by the lady who did the translation. I know, don't, before you say anything. It's very interesting, but on page 77...
It was originally written in Latin.
Yeah, oh, yeah, she translated it.
Mm-hmm.
Say a man has killed someone. Why has he done so? He was in love with another man's wife or property, or he wanted to ransack his property for something to live on, or he was afraid of losing a considerable part of his own wealth to that other man, or after being injured, he burned to avenge himself. Surely, Augustine writes, he would not commit murder without a reason, just for the pleasure of the act. Even Catiline, a man who's said to be both insane and excessively cruel, excessively because he was evil and cruel for cruelty's sake, had his reasons for acting, thus revealed, Catiline. So that neither hand nor heart would grow slack through idleness. Now ask this too. Why? Why so? It's astonishing. The questions remain.
They've been thinking about it for years.
Yes, and that's St. Augustine.
Mm. Well,
who lived, just in case anybody's in any doubt, from AD 354 to AD 430.
Bloody hell. It was a while ago then.
Yes, a good while.
Mm.
A couple of millennia.
I think that perfectly proves that we cannot answer the question, why do people kill and are people born evil?
Yes, but it's...
I think we can all step aside from that one now and work out that we don't know.
We can say, well, leave it to St. Augustine.
Well, he didn't know. We certainly don't know.
He didn't know. We don't know.
Thousands of years later, we still don't know.
We still don't know. But isn't it? It's fascinating, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, true. It's interesting.
You know, because one of the things that lies at the heart of this podcast, which we ask ourselves often, is why? It's the question I get asked the most. Why did he? Or why did she?
Mm.
And the honest answer is we can't explain it. I mean, it is... No, it's. I don't believe it's an evil gene. No, I don't believe it's... You know, the old joke, my mother made me a serial killer. Well, if she made you one, could she make me one too? You know, it's not every child who has, a dysfunctional childhood turns into a killer.
It's very true.
No, not everyone who has a wealthy upbringing turns out to be lovely or pleasant or... And I'm about this case today is exactly that.
What are we doing today?
Well, we're doing a case of the murder of a woman called Stephanie Bryan. Stephanie Bryan actually was only 14 years old. This is a very famous case in America. Probably the most notorious murder trial just after the last war, the Second World War. Took place in 1955. It was all in San Francisco, and it became a real cause célèbre. And if you type in murder of Stephanie Bryan into your search engine, you'll come up with the name of Burton Abbott. And Burton Abbott was indeed the killer of Stephanie Bryan.
So what are we calling this then?
The murder of Stephanie Bryan.
Yes, here we go. All right, well, here we go with the murder of Stephanie Bryan.
We're talking about the 1950s. Really quite a different era. Diners and... Long before any kind of mobile phones, internets, in many ways, a very much calmer time. Stephanie Bryan was a schoolgirl who was in the habit of walking home with her friend, Mary Stewart, on the way to her house in Alvarado Street. She lived in a place called Alameda in California, Northern California. Stephanie was last seen by her friend walking across the parking lot of a hotel called the Claremont, as it was a shortcut to a lane that led up from the car park to her street. So she crossed the car park, up the lane, and then she was in her own home street. By 4:15 on the afternoon of April the 28th, 1955, Stephanie had not come home, and her mother was very, very worried. She phoned the school and said, you know, is Stephanie still there? No, she's left. She left with her friend. So she phones her husband, who's works as a radiologist at Oakland Hospital. He comes home, still no sign of Stephanie. They go out and look, you know, where she, her normal route, no sign. And so they call the police, not surprisingly. A massive search is launched. I mean, it is comparatively unusual. This broad daylight, a white girl, middle class area, and yet there's no real sign of anything except one or two witnesses say they saw a girl in the back of a grey Pontiac car screaming no at the driver, who was turning round to hit her. Now, as Stephanie's father was to say later, have we really come to a time when if you saw something like that, you wouldn't report it to the police? Well, probably we would now, but would you then? I'm not certain.
I don't know.
You know, yeah. It's a very difficult one. People are reluctant to come forward. They don't want to make... Maybe I got it wrong. Maybe I didn't see it. Maybe it was misinterpreted. Well... by and large, but the point is, nothing is found, not a trace of Stephanie Bryan. Some months later, in July 1955, Georgia Abbott, who was Burton Abbott's wife, and is 5 years older than Burton Abbott, I'll come to Burton Abbott's background in a moment, goes into the basement because she wants to find something to dress up in for a fancy dress party. And there's all sorts of things in the basement of their house, which are in a, like a dressing up box. In the dressing up box, she discovers a purse, a red purse. She opens the purse, and inside the purse is the ID of Stephanie Bryan. The man she's gone into the basement with to look for dressing up clothes, called Otto Desmond, insists she calls the police. The police are called and they arrive at the Abbott's house. Now, I should explain about this. Georgia Abbott is a little older, 5 years older, than her husband, Burton Abbott, Burton Wilbur Abbott, to give him his exact name, who was born in February 1928. When the police arrive, Burton Abbott is supremely disinterested. I mean, this is a high-profile disappearance, and the ID's turned up in the basement of their house. Oh, he says, he's actually doing a crossword puzzle when the police arrive. He's so disinterested, he's sitting in the corner with the paper doing a crossword puzzle. Oh, hundreds of people walked through. It was a polling station. I don't know how he got there. So the police ask Burton Abbott to account for his movements on the 28th of April 1955. And he comes up with a whole string of very convoluted. He was driving, and I think he's drove. I went to Sacramento, and then I drove to the family's cabin in the Trinity County Mountains. Because I thought I might stay for a day or two. It's a completely bizarre construction. But this, of course, the cabin, we should say, is 285 miles away from Alamada, where the house is. But this excites interest, I mean, enormous amount of interest. The police, the newspapers, and one particularly, how can I put it, enterprising reporter called Ed Montgomery, who was working for the San Francisco Examiner, hires a private plane, takes a photographer, and goes to the cabin. They then persuade the locals to get their dogs to see if they can find, you know, Stephanie's body. They search and they search, and then almost as they're about to stop, the dogs come across a limb sticking out from the ground, the shallow grave. And there is the body of Stephanie Bryan, decomposed.
Goodness.
Decomposed now, of course. So on the July, that was July the 20th. So she disappeared on April the 28th, and they finally find the body on July the 20th. You have to say it's one of the great scoops of the 1950s. You know, because not many newspaper men actually find the body. It's and not surprisingly, the San Francisco Examiner made some play with that. It doesn't come as any surprise to anybody that Burton Abbott is now not only prime suspect, but
the only suspect, and it's not looking good.
And every inch of his alibi quotes about driving and is pulled to bits, and one neighbour in the cabin says he was rather surprised when he saw Burton up there that day in April, because he didn't invite him in, because normally he used to invite him in, you know. And then he phones the family up and says, oh, don't come up to the cabin this weekend, the weather's not very good. I mean, a whole series of really, but, and it's important to say this, but the evidence against Burton Abbott is circumstantial at best. No fingerprints, no forensics. Well, we're in long before DNA and any of that. But nevertheless, in November, Burton Abbott goes on trial. It's an absolute sensation. The famous crime writer, Earl Stanley Gardner, is commissioned to go and sit in the court throughout this very high-profile hearing. Perhaps not quite as high-profile as Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, but certainly getting that way.
Oh, yeah.
The prosecution allege that Burton Abbott had tried to rape Stephanie, and she refused his advances, and he killed her because she refused to cooperate. The DA called Abbott the epitome of extreme vanity, egoism, and selfishness. But he pleaded not guilty. He claimed, as he had in the original police interview, the house had been loads of people in through the house. I don't know how it got there. I had nothing to do with it. And besides, oh yes, I happen to have owned a grey Pontiac in April, but I sold it almost immediately.
Mm.
You know, but
I get it's not hard and fast.
The pathologist here testified that the body was so decomposed it was impossible to confirm any kind of sexual assault. And then Abbott takes the stand. And for 4 days, pretty much underlines the DA's view of him. He's bad-tempered, cocky, irate, and then sulking and just does himself no good. In other words, he'd be better not to have gone on the stand.
Mm.
He calls it a monstrous frame-up. The evidence is non-existent. And besides, it's all circumstantial. Well, that was the mistake. If Abbott had simply said, it's a mistake, and not revealed an element of his character on the stand, he might well have convinced, or at least his defence attorneys might well have convinced the jury that this was simply too flimsy to convict. Nevertheless, when the jury finally went out in the middle of January 1956, they deliberated for 7 days before coming back with a conviction for first-degree murder.
7 days.
It's a long time.
A long time.
He's also convicted of kidnap. But well, there's no alternative in 1955. The judge has no alternative but to issue a death penalty notice, which is immediately goes to automatically refer to the Supreme Court in California, who indeed confirm it.
Mm-hmm. Burton, when did the death penalty end in the US? Oh, it's still there.
In some states. Yeah, not
stupid
all.
Stupid question.
Yeah.
Sorry, carry on.
No. One of the things that may finally have convinced the jury, which is not revealed until very near the end of the trial, when the prosecution are closing, is that when Stephanie's body is found, finally, it should also add that her glasses and her spectacles were found in the basement of Burton Abbott's house, but other parts of her underwear are twisted round her neck, adding to the thought that there's a sexual element to this crime. Abbott is sent to San Quentin to wait a sentence, still saying, well, it wasn't me. It could have been that man Desmond who went down to the cellar with my wife.
And planted it there.
Who planted it there. Mm. It's not me. It's absolutely not. It's absolutely impossible. Another marvellous moment in this trial is, we should add, that Abbott had suffered from tuberculosis as a young man. And he had a very concave chest, you know, very sunk in because of the tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. In fact, he'd met his wife, Georgia, while he was in hospital as a patient, and she was a nurse.
Oh.
She was quite young. I mean, they had a child called Christopher who was 4 at the time of the killing. So he would have been a young man.
Yeah.
For her part, Georgia also insisted that Byrne Abbott was innocent and continued to insist because she was living in the house with Burton, their son Christopher, and Burton's mother, Elsie. Perhaps that's how they managed to afford a house. Perhaps it was pooled all the family resources. The family weren't poor. Mm. But at one point in the courtroom, in the defence attempted to show that Abbott wouldn't be capable of this kind of killing because look at him, he's so weak. And they, astonishingly enough, he strips off, takes all his shirt off.
Oh, Lord.
In front of the jury.
No thanks.
It's another moment of the most wonderful drama. Nevertheless, the death penalty goes ahead. The defence appeal to the state Supreme Court. Then they appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States. Everybody says there's no reason to delay the execution, which has been set, I just want to get the date absolutely correct, which is set for 10 a.m. on March the 15th, 1957. Now, in one of those marvellous American moments, it's the telephone call to the governor. You know, can the governor delay the execution? It happens in films time after time, but this really did happen.
Mm.
And the governor of California at that moment was not in his office in Sacramento. He's on a ship. And it took some time for them to find him. Anyway, they finally do find him when he gets back on dry land. And he grants a 1-hour stay of execution so that they can go through another appeal. The appeal fails, but the defence go back to the governor and say, could you give us another hour? But Burton Abbott has been executed 3 minutes before that final telephone call. It's a gas chamber execution. And he phones the warden. The governor phones the warden and says, is it time to, have I got time to stop it? And he said, no.
It's done.
With Burton Abbott still insisting.
He was innocent.
He didn't do it, and it was nothing to do with him. And that it was to quote him, a monstrous frame-up.
We'll never know.
Well, it's interesting that not one but two of our listeners, one very sweetly, B Beagle on Instagram, and another one, an anonymous person on Instagram, both pointed me at this case.
Very interesting case.
It is actually. And it's another, I know I go on about this, but it's another wonderful moral dilemma. Should Burton Abbott have died?
Well, that would be solved by not having the death penalty, which you don't approve of anyway, really.
No. But
I mean, that would be the only way
to
because, I mean, you could be convicted wrongly, but at least there would be time to try and...
Yeah, I think you could say that Burton Abbott wasn't exactly his own best defender.
Yeah. Or he might just have been guilty.
Yes. Of the two, I should probably say, suspect...
The latter. Sounds like it to me, not that I would want to...
You know, I mean, why put the stuff in the basement of your house and then why sell the Pontiac? Why bury the body near the cabin that you happen to own in the woods in Trinity County?
It's all a bit suspicious, isn't it?
Trinity County Mountains, I mean...
But he could have been framed still.
Hence his use of the phrase monstrous frame-up. But who? Who would want to? This is a 28-year-old accountancy student at the University of California. We are talking about nerd of the century. He also submitted a lie detector test.
I see that in the pictures. Yeah.
But which was inconclusive.
I'm not sure about those.
Well, neither am I. I agree with you, absolutely. But
I'd be so nervous, I'd just come out as if I was lying about everything. Because yes. I get super anxious when I think people think I've done something wrong.
Yes. But it is. It was a very, very big
deal at the time.
And, caused an absolute sensation in California.
Well, there you go.
And that was the murder of Stephanie Ryan.
Murder of Stephanie Ryan. Thanks, Dad.
Well, thank our listeners for suggesting it.
Thanks for suggesting it, guys.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
We love your suggestions. Please do write or message us on Instagram.
Yes.
You can email us at bloodties.podcast@gmail.com, or you can find Jeffrey's email on his website, or you can go on Instagram or Twitter with bloodties_pod.
That's how you do it, is it?
That's how you do it, Dad.
Okay. I've never done it.
That's how you do it.
Well, there you go. I just tell the stories, I think.
Yeah, you just turn up. You just do the work and tell the stories.
Just tell the stories.
We'll do the rest.
Let the experts do the rest.
Yeah.
But, I find it good because, this is hiding in plain sight, all right. Yes, it's Burton Abbott.
Who knows?
Who knows? Fascinating, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Those big cases that really capture the imagination, yes, are really fascinating ones, aren't, yeah, they? Ones you can base dramas off and,
yes,
have you.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the Carl is so interesting too, because it's comparatively harmless. You know, it's a suburban street with a little alley behind a hotel, going beside a hotel, and... it's certainly not mean streets any way.
No, right, yeah, I see what you mean.
It's not the...
Not what you would expect, so it's not surprising it became a big deal.
No, and besides, she was a white girl.
Indeed. Indeedy. Well, thank you very much, and thank you to all the people who help us, our producer Sam Brain, my brother Dan, who plays the music, my friend George, who drew our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, to Jeffrey for all the hard work, and to you, the listeners, thank you so much.
Yes, I couldn't agree more, Molly. Thank you so much to everyone for listening, for sticking with us, for contacting us, for being so supportive. Molly sent me some fascinating figures this week about how many listeners we had last year.
I can only just about decipher those.
Well, it seems that we have more than 250,000.
Did we?
285,000.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God. What are you all doing?
Now.
Well, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. Thank you, Molly, for thinking the idea up. And in the meantime, think of poor Stephanie Bryan. Bad things do happen to good people, so too.